This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane in for Terry Gross. It's been a rough couple of weeks for tobacco companies. Several more states' attorneys general have filed suit against the industry, hoping to recoup the costs of paying for smoking-related illnesses, making the total number of states 24. Individual cases against specific tobacco companies are making their way through various court systems around the country. And last Friday, a federal judge in North Carolina ruled that the federal government, meaning the Food and Drug Administration, has the authority to regulate cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. This is a huge defeat for tobacco companies, who have lobbied long and hard to keep the FDA's hands off tobacco, fearing the agency would take measures to regulate the amount of nicotine in cigarettes. The judge also ruled that the FDA has no authority to restrict tobacco advertising and promotions, which was a blow to anti-smoking forces. We invited Philip Hilps to join us today to put this news in context. He writes about health and science for the New York Times and is the author of the book Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up, which was published last year. He says what's truly significant about this recent ruling is that for the first time, a court has labeled nicotine a drug.
The law says that the agency in the government that is supposed to be watching drugs, who sells them, how they're sold, what's a drug, what's not a drug, is the Food and Drug Administration. And because of some peculiarities in history, tobacco had been left out of that. And so for years, people have been trying to put it back in and say, this is, after all, a drug. Let's go ahead and have FDA regulated. But then David Kessler, at the head of the FDA in 1994, said, we're going to investigate this, and we are going to put together enough information to convince everybody that nicotine is a drug. This is what the companies intend. They intend to use it as a drug. And he did that. And so he then declared, okay, nicotine is a drug. FDA will regulate it from now on, despite the history. And then the companies came in and said, no, wait a minute. We're going to court. We're going to block that. And what we have now is the result of that fight. And the court, and this is a court in Greensboro, North Carolina, tobacco country,
right.
A judge who understands the companies because he's worked with them. He represented tobacco farmers himself. So this is their best venue. And this judge quite clearly said the FDA is right. Nicotine is a drug. Cigarettes are a drug delivery device, and it should be regulated.
Now, the other half of the judge's decision said that the FDA could not restrict tobacco advertising or the promotion of tobacco products. On what legal grounds did he make this argument?
Yeah, it was kind of a narrow ground. What he said was, if anybody's going to be regulating the advertising of a product, it's got to be the FTC, which is the agency normally that does that sort of thing. And in the law, the FDA, it says the FDA can regulate sale, manufacture, but it doesn't say advertising. Normally with drugs, you don't regulate the advertising in the way that you'd regulate, say, the Marlboro Man, because drugs normally aren't handled that way. So what he said was the FDA law doesn't say you should handle advertising. The FTC law says you should. So he said, if you're going to do it, let the FTC do it. Do not let the FDA do it. But he also made a point. He said, I'm not going to rule on the general issue of whether advertising constitutes free speech and that kind of thing. Not the constitutional issue. He stayed away from that. Just on the narrow legal grounds, he said FDA is the wrong agency to be doing it.
So Joe Camel will be around for a while.
Yes. At least until the companies decide not to use him.
Are you surprised at all about this judge from North Carolina, the country's number one tobacco state, that this judge issued this particular ruling? Back in the 70s, he did represent tobacco companies as a private attorney. Many people are fairly surprised by his strong ruling. Are you?
I was surprised. I thought it would go the other way. I thought he would find some grounds to protect the companies. If there's anybody who could see this from the company's point of view, it would have been him. But I read his ruling, and what you can see as he goes through it, what he's thinking is, the law, and this is actually pretty clear, the law says if an agency's job is to regulate something like drugs and they do a reasonable interpretation of what the law says, then they should go ahead. And the only body that can stop them is Congress. Congress can change their marching orders. But once Congress has given the marching order, says, FDA, you regulate drugs, they're doing it in a reasonable way, they ought to go ahead. And so he said, you can't deny it. It's a reasonable thing for the FDA to be doing.
How do the courts define a drug? And of course, this has been one of the issues which has made this such a contentious issue.
Yeah. The main thing is, it says, the law says, anything that affects the structure or function of the body and that the seller of it intends for it to do that. So in this case, you have the tobacco coming into the lungs, and it's affecting the lungs, of course. The tobacco itself is tearing up the lungs. But mainly what we're talking about is the nicotine, which goes directly into the bloodstream, up to the brain, across to receptors all over the brain, and creates this buzz, this simultaneous calm and alertness, which smokers enjoy. That's the effect of a drug. And then the question is intent. Mm-hmm. Do the companies and have the companies marketed this product with the intention of getting the nicotine from their plant into the lungs of the smokers? And the FDA investigation, which took a couple of years, found all the internal evidence which suggests that the companies knew perfectly well what they were doing. They regulated the amount of nicotine in there. They didn't go too high or too low. They made sure plenty was being delivered and so on. So the answer was, yes, the companies intended to get nicotine to their smokers. And that's all you have to have, is it is a drug and it was intended.
When you look at this particular ruling and the fact that states' attorneys general have sued tobacco companies to recover some of the costs of smoking of smokers within their own states, is the tide beginning to turn against the tobacco industry?
I think so. I think what has happened here, this is all of one piece. You had a time in 1952 and 53 when tobacco was king. Half the population was smoking. It was in the movies. And there was a crisis when the scientific data came in that showed this is causing a huge epidemic of disease. Cigarettes specifically are causing this epidemic of lung cancer and heart disease. But the companies fought that and struggled to a standstill. So for the last 40 years, not much has happened. But then beginning in 1994, we had a sudden breakout. Whistleblowers coming out, huge amounts of documents, the FDA declaring that it was going to investigate and try to regulate the nicotine as a drug. And so the thing broke. And at that point, all this information feeds into the normal processes of American society. You're talking about courts, the Justice Department, Congress, debates everywhere, newspapers. And as it works its way through the system from 1994 till now, you can see the companies losing one after another. There was a loss in court in Florida. The 24 attorneys general now have gone into court against them. One item after another, they're gradually, this information is working its way through the system.
In March, the Liggett company, maker of Chesterfield, made a startling admission. Quote, "We at Liggett know and acknowledge that cigarette smoking causes health problems, including lung cancer, heart and vascular disease, and emphysema." What does this statement represent, coming from a small tobacco company, but coming from a tobacco company?
It represents the great desire of the executives of the companies and the scientists at the companies to get out from under the burden that they've been carrying for 40 years. They're as aware, much more aware, in fact, of all the details of what cigarettes do than the rest of us. They really know it, but they've been blocked because of a strategy they picked a while back, legally blocked from being out front about it. And for the last 40 years, that hasn't mattered too much, because what's happened is their profits have kept up year after year, and the number of smokers has been still relatively high. But now they're facing a real problem. They really may be attacked, not only in this country, but their worldwide sales would be threatened if they started losing suits one after another, and if the Justice Department indicts them, and if, and if, and if. So they need to get out from under this denial phase and get into a point where they can negotiate directly with members of Congress, with lawyers, with the public at large. They must make a deal with the public at large about how we're going to handle cigarettes in society. And the first thing they have to do is come clean. And so that's what's happened with Liggett, and now it's beginning to happen with the other companies.
The Liggett settlement included using 25% of pre-tax income over the next 25 years to pay for public service announcements, and I assume warnings, even more warnings about cigarette smoking. Is there more that they agreed to, and did they agree to use the word addictive?
Yes, they agreed to a lot more. Probably the most important thing they agreed to was to turn over all their files, all these papers, which shows what they've known over the years, that they knew it was addictive, that they knew it was harmful, that they were, and this was a really incredible admission, that they did directly target children and intended to as young as 12, 13, 14 years old. These kind of admissions they made, and they said they will turn over their papers and they will testify. All their executives will go into court and testify against the other companies. So that's really significant turnaround. Of course, it doesn't cost them much financially to do this, mm-hmm. but it's a big thing for the plaintiffs to have these people in court fighting against the other tobacco executives. And I think that's probably the single greatest reason why the executives from RJR and Philip Morris are now themselves negotiating, because it's going to be hard for them to go into court and argue against Liggett.
Well, with all these negotiations going on and with more and more documents coming to light, do the tobacco companies, and I guess I'm thinking of the big ones, do they still maintain that there's no particular health risk associated with smoking? Do they still hold to that?
Well, this is kind of a funny question. In court, when you ask them, and there were depositions a few days ago in Florida, the head of RJR, Schindler, was asked these questions. And he said, as they have said all along, no, I don't believe it's harmful. No, I don't believe it's addictive. This is what he's saying in court under oath.
Right.
On the other hand, privately and at the table of these negotiations, they really have a very different feel about what they say. They say, well, yeah, you know, there is a problem. We know. We're going to admit that and so on. But they can't do it legally in a formal setting. So because the negotiations are going on, you have this kind of two things going at the same time. Eventually, it'll be resolved. Presumably, when the negotiations are over, they will be able to finally admit it. But legally, if they admit it, it gets them in trouble.
I'm wondering, though, because these are people who are testifying under oath, how they even say that and whether they come down to saying things like, well, there's no actual proof, or there are, I assume there are studies. I mean, you can find a study to prove just about anything or not prove just about anything. How do they position that in court?
They themselves have a lot of documents showing what cigarettes do, and they acknowledge that their own scientists have demonstrated that cigarettes cause various kinds of illness and so on. But they don't want to say proof. They say, we don't actually have the final proof. They say, well, it's a risk factor. And I think you have to ask a psychological question here, because they can't legally admit it. Their lawyers tell them, don't admit it. Don't say directly it causes it, because that'll get us in trouble. But so what you have is the heads of the companies saying what they believe they have to say in court, while privately they probably have a different opinion. In fact, I don't know about Schindler, but I have talked to some other tobacco company executives privately who are quite straight about it. They say, absolutely, of course it causes these problems. Of course it causes disease. But they can't do it publicly. So it's a difficult psychological bind for them, in a sense. They'd like to be able to admit it, but it could hurt their industry if they do, at least now. Maybe 2 weeks from now, when the negotiations are over, they will be able to.
What about the question about, and again, I guess looking at proof and what tobacco industry folks are willing to say in court and what they're willing to say when they're negotiating with attorneys general or perhaps members of Congress. Are they willing to make the link between smoking and addiction?
Yes. The Liggett has done that already, and the companies at the table have said or suggested that they will do that also, that they are willing to admit that it is addictive, that they have targeted children, and that it does cause cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and so on. That will be one of the results, probably, of the negotiation if it's successful. And they have offered to do that, assuming they can have what they need. And from their point of view, of course, that is they need to keep their business alive. They need to have some kind of immunity from the number of suits out there and so on.
Philip Hiltz is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a writer for The New York Times, covers health and science. Last year came out with a book called Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. And we're talking about the various lawsuits that are making their ways through the court system dealing with tobacco companies. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is New York Times writer Philip Hiltz, and we're talking about smoking and the tobacco industry. You know, when you think about the anti-smoking education campaign in the last couple of decades in this country, several surgeon generals, including C. Everett Koop, coming out very strongly against tobacco. And then you look at the numbers of teenagers, the increasing numbers of teenagers that are smoking. Is there a danger of making smoking so forbidden that teenagers will do it because it's their way of rebelling in those adolescent years, that way of sort of defining themselves against the culture?
Yes, I think that's what's happened so far. And the ads, the PSAs, the education campaign so far hasn't dented that. The fact is that the teenage smoking is going back up.
Yeah.
That's a good indication that the one image, that is the image of being tough and independent and smoking helps give you an identity, is succeeding. And the other image of death and destruction that will come to you later on is not succeeding. The only way to deal with that is, and if you have any faith in advertisers, you can assume that there are ways to get to the psychology of teenage smokers, but they haven't been tried yet. And in fact, the people who know this best and have outlined this are the tobacco companies themselves in confidential documents. They talk about what would have an effect on teenagers, but they've never been used by the other side. What they say is, for example, at the bottom of the desire to smoke is insecurity. The teenagers are who start smoking are less secure than the average teenager. And they're more worried about themselves, and they need this badge more than anyone. And what the teenagers fear is that people will see them as more insecure and more needy and more of a problem personality. So what the companies have done is they've hidden that by saying, if you smoke, it's going to give you a boost. You're going to look more manly or more macho or more free or whatever. What the companies fear is that the other side will see this and go after the insecurity and say, one teenager to another, you realize when you pick that up, everybody knows you're more insecure, that you really, psychologically, you have more problems than the rest of us, that you're, in fact, weaker-willed than the rest of us. If you went with that line, you'd have a much bigger effect. Of course, it's not easy to do. You'd have to have professional advertising people doing it. Right. You'd have to package it the right way and have enough dollars to get it across so that it's a competing message. But that's the one thing that has not been tried and the thing that the companies in their documents say they fear.
We've been talking about some of the legal rulings and tobacco in the last month or so, but I wonder whether there's now pressure on politicians to do something more in Congress. And I know from the last election, I think there was some $6.8 million in soft money that went to the 96 election, and this is from the Center for Responsive Politics. About 85% of that went to the Republican Party for their party organizations and the get out the vote and all the things that soft money can do. But I wonder, as pressure is exerted more from the public and more information comes out about what tobacco companies know about tobacco products, whether that's really going to change what happens in Congress.
Yeah, so the landscape is completely different than it was. Over the last 40 years, what you had is the tobacco lobbies had a high presence in Congress. They were there with the money when the people needed it. And then when the votes came, the votes were always private. They were always small. They were never noticed. The issue was never out there in a big way. So it was quite easy for the people in Congress, the senators and representatives, to go along with tobacco, take the money, because it was never a big deal in the district. It meant nothing. Now the situation has just turned around. The issue is big and getting bigger. It is going to be a big, bitter fight when it gets to Congress. And the representatives are no longer going to be able to do anything quietly. If they take the money, they're going to be marked for it, and then they're going to have to argue for it. So it's a very different situation, and you can see the politicians one by one turning around on it. And a number of them recently have said, okay, no more tobacco money for me. These are the more liberal ones. There's still a large number of congressmen taking a large amount of money, but the situation is quite different now. And it will end up in Congress. There's almost no way around that. After these negotiations, if there's some kind of settlement worked out, it doesn't automatically happen. You have to take it to some body to ratify, some way society itself is putting the stamp on the deal.
And what goes back to Congress is what's under the jurisdiction of the FDA and the FTC and other government organizations?
Various things. The single most important item would be, can we prevent citizens of the United States from suing the companies?
Mm-hmm.
You have to pass a law that says you may not sue the companies. And whether that's constitutional or unconstitutional, Congress has to pass a law saying that. And that's what the companies want. They want immunity from prosecution, immunity from suits, immunity from suits of the states, immunity from the Justice Department itself. And Congress is the only one that can do that.
Well, Philip Hiltz, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Philip Hiltz writes about health and science for the New York Times and is the author of Smokescreen, The Truth Behind the Tobacco Industry Cover-Up. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.